Hey guys, did you know that you can subscribe to the Investor Coaching Show podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts? When you subscribe, you get notifications with new episodes so you never have to go looking for an episode or worry about what you've missed. So if you're on your phone or computer, go ahead and pause the episode real quick and become a subscriber. If you're not sure how to subscribe, go to paulwinkler.com/how-to-subscribe, all one word, how to subscribe, for instructions, or click the link in the show note. Now let's get started.
Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
And welcome to the Investor Coaching Show. I am Paul Winkler. He is Jonathan Walker, and she is Ann Sawaski. All multi-degreed, multi-talented, brilliant planners in their own rights, with lots and lots and lots of experience. So I need to shut up this hour and let them talk more. That's what's got to happen.
Uh-oh.
You guys are...
Man, you're on a roll.
Yeah.
But I'm always on a roll.
Well, that's true.
I mean, that pretty much always happens. What's this, Ann, that baby boomers are ready to retire? The pandemic has worn baby boomers out. Is that basically what you were telling me?
Yeah, I saw this article that the pandemic has changed the attitude of baby boomers.
I think I can see that.
Yeah, and I can kind of see that in a certain respect. But they said that older Americans are ready to opt out of the workforce altogether, even if it means a more modest retirement, according to a new survey.
That might get old.
Yeah.
Modest retirement may be a little bit overrated when you can't afford health care later on and going, oh my goodness, this was a little bit too modest.
Well,
I didn't realize that I'd have to hire a witch doctor.
Well, and especially when we talked about inflation and Social Security too. So, yeah.
But I think that the general idea of slowing down is hitting a lot of people. I think that the idea of going and saying, okay, you know what, life isn't neat. I think a lot of it has to do with loss.
You know, yes.
As you get into the retirement years, what ends up happening is you start to see loss around you. You mm-hmm. maybe spouse, friends, family members, mm-hmm. Parents for if you're a little bit younger, and you start to go, well, you know what? Maybe there's more to life than 9 to 5, or you know, if it's 9 to 9, if you know, so for some people working, you know, half days, mm-hmm. and you know. All of a sudden, you realize that maybe I need to slow down a little bit and want to do something a little bit different. So I think that that's interesting that we're seeing that.
Yeah, so the survey said that almost 4 in 5 boomers reported they'd rather retire at age 65 mm-hmm. and live out their years in modesty than work till 75 and live large, according to the survey. And they're not interested in second act or encore careers, and they're not planning on working in retirement. And this is actually a change. And
they're not at all at working in retirement?
Nope.
Nope.
55% of them said, nope, not going to do it.
Now, I think it was Jim that was talking about a couple weeks ago, this house you could buy for like a couple $1,000s. Mm-hmm. You could build a whole thing that might be like income.
Yeah.
You're talking like a tiny house?
A tiny house.
Yeah. I think we were talking minimalism.
All right. Yeah. But here's the interesting thing about it is, they do feel like workplace changes over the last 18 months with COVID were a big part of it because, and when you think about it, mm-hmm. you know, COVID, yes, has caused a big change in the way we work. So for one thing, a lot of people are spending their whole day on Zoom.
Right.
Which they really didn't do before.
That is fatiguing just thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then a lot of people, I think, feel isolation because they're working at home a lot and they're not seeing people. And that's part of being in the workplace, you know. And so, I mean, I think there's a lot of that. And then, of course, there's just fatigue with the whole COVID and you couldn't do this and you couldn't do that. And you can't see these people. And so I think people are starting to consider What is more important? And is it more important for me to have these opportunities to see family and have experiences, or is it more important for me to work longer and deal with these technology issues and probably risk, health risks that they might think about too?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I would think that what would happen, just because I've seen this with various family members, is they get up to that age, to retirement, and then they cut loose. And then after 6 months, they're so bored that they have to get back to doing something else, and maybe they'll be doing more consulting. And I think there'd be a double whammy. If you have a lot of baby boomers doing this, then the companies themselves are going to be going, you know, we just lost most of our really talented, really well-educated, really experienced people. And yeah, we're going to bring you back as consultants. I think that may be what ends up happening.
Yeah. Here's another thing I thought was interesting, though, is it said that those with savings are willing to use it all and not leave a financial legacy if it means 10 fewer working years. 77% of baby boomers said that, and that's a new attitude.
Well, so here's my concern about that. You don't have anything, any savings, so you're spending it down, which means you better be really, really good at figuring out exactly what your life expectancy is.
Right,
B, that whole thing about what if we have these cost of living increases for Social Security that get more than offset by healthcare costs because of Medicare premiums, because of taxes on Social Security, then, you know, you may say that right now, but when you look back and you're 80, there's no going back and saying, you know, give me a, what do they call it in golf?
A mulligan.
A mulligan. There you go. You see how much Paul plays golf.
Yeah, I think the way that I
need a mulligan on this retirement plan.
the way I interpreted that was that, you know, there's
that
a
worm
lot of
burner's just going to have to, you're going to stick with it.
Yeah. The way I interpret that, though, is a lot of people generationally feel like they need to leave some type of financial legacy. Mm-hmm. And instead of doing that, where that had been a burden, they don't want to run out of money. They're just like, look, my goal is not to leave that financial legacy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's I'm going to utilize this money for what I need to utilize it for, whether it's, you know, travel or long-term care expenses or whatever the number is. I know nobody wants to run out of money, but I think there used to be a more of a pre-COVID, there was more of an emphasis put on, okay, what is my financial legacy? Whereas now it's, I don't really care about the financial legacy. I want to spend time with my grandkids, or I want to do this.
And leave a personal legacy.
Yeah, I'm going to leave a personal legacy. I'm going to leave those memories. I have a lot of clients that are not spending a ton of money on Christmas gifts that are not purchased from small businesses. They're small business oriented, or there's something that they can do. It's an experience. Yeah. And so they're doing that versus kind of leaving any type of financial legacy.
Yeah, I think, you know, when it comes down to it, a lot of times, you know, when we're looking at an investment portfolio and saying, okay, I need my investments to provide an income for life. And quite often we're telling people what the withdrawal rate is.
Right.
The withdrawal rate that we often talk about works simply because it's less than the long-term expected return.
Right.
And since 1900, that's where the data goes back to, it has been less than the long-term expected return of a portfolio that is well-diversified. But here's what makes it work. If I have a return, let's say my return exceeds my withdrawal rate, then I have extra money going back toward the principal, which gives me the ability to have the COLAs. Mm-hmm. I actually did this years ago where I took an example using a withdrawal rate that equaled the long-term expected return. So, you know, people would say this, just give me all the return from my portfolio let me withdraw all of that so I can live at a higher level. And what ended up happening, which really, it surprised me, but it didn't surprise me. The overall amount of income that I was able to take from the portfolio, if you add it all up, was actually less when I took a higher withdrawal rate. And the reason is because what happens is you have what's called sequence of returns risk. And in English, what that is that when I'm pulling money out of a portfolio, if it's going up, I'm fine. If I pull out 5% of my portfolio value, but it went up 15, no problem. I got another 10% that goes back to the principal. But if I have a 10% with a decline in my portfolio and I take out 5, now I'm down 15. Now I'm starting down 85% of my original value. And now to overcome that, I have to have a much bigger return to overcome it. Because, and let me just use a ridiculous example so you get where I'm coming from. If you have a 50% decline in your portfolio value, what does it take to get back to where you started? 100%. So you have to have a bigger upside to get back where you were before when you have a downward trend. So in essence, when I do this and I take out too much money, and if I'm taking out too high of a distribution rate, because I'm taking out so much, it forces me to sell stocks when I really don't want to be selling stocks. Mm-hmm. Is really why it doesn't work out so well. So, you know, typically what you got to do with people quite often is balance these two things, is, you know, balance these goals. And, you know, legacy is kind of it's a happy side effect of mm-hmm. taking out an income from a portfolio when you have it set up in such a way that it increases your income throughout your life. Because you might be around here for 35 years.
Right.
You know, you might be around for quite a while in retirement, and, you know, the money's got to last. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're worried about Social Security, you know, for younger people, you know, you're looking at what kind of cutbacks could they be doing when you're age 85? You know, when you're age 80. And, you know, it's something that needs to be thought about regarding this.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
So it is interesting. So baby boomers may be changing a little bit. And I think, you know, I think it is a good idea. I remember there was a guy that was a mentor of mine early on. And he was a mentor in so many ways, not only in planning, but in the way he lived his life. And he came from, now this guy was in, he was a financial planner, but he came from the teaching profession. And what he did that I thought was so good was he said, you know, I work from like September all the way till like April or May or whatever it was. And he says, and during the summer, you can't find me. And, you know, that I was like, I couldn't get away with that.
Yeah.
But you know, but he got away with it. Somehow he had the right setup that he could get away with. But it was funny what he would just say. And this could be for you, whatever profession you're in, that maybe you have certain times that you work and you work, you know, you work hard or you work, you know, a lot or do whatever you do. But you have times that you just play hard. And you get out and you just, you know, your grandkids are going to get tired of you. You know, you can say, I'm going to go out there. I want to hang out. You know, if you hung out with your grandkids 4 months out of the year, maybe that might be enough. I don't know. But, you know, just think about that you might be able to be this person that works for a week, takes off a week, you know, works for 2 weeks, takes off 2 weeks. And then, you know, you might, and maybe that's what you structure your retirement at so that you can have, you know, those types of, that type of a. Of a retirement, you know, maybe balance it.
I think that's the biggest thing. You know, I mean, that article I think probably strikes home with a lot of people. If anything, the last 18 months has made a lot of us reevaluate what our priorities are, and you know, maybe I can live with. And I'm just going to make up numbers. Maybe I can live with, you know, 800,000 instead of 1 million, or I can live with half a million instead of 700,000, you know, as far as retirement assets. You know, really how important is it to me? There's you have to determine what, and it's different for everybody. But, you know, the reality is that I think, you know, looking at things, and not only that, what's providing the what does that represent?
I think it's a really good point.
The piece asset of it?
Yeah.
To me, that, you know, talking to clients about that is, you know, truly let's figure out what makes the most sense and what's the most important to you, and then make sure that it's reflective in your financial plan.
Well, and I think that really would be a case, especially with a person that says, hey, my belief before was he who dies with the most toys wins, the most money in the bank account wins. And then you start to realize, you know, that's not really that.
You know, I had a client that came in. I had a potential client. He did not become a client, but he came in and this was pre-COVID. This was right before everything hit. It was like October before everything kind of hit in January. Mm-hmm. He was 52 and he had $3.5 million in his 401k plan. Mm-hmm. Really nice guy. Mm-hmm. And he made the comment that he said, I'll be happy when it gets to $4 million. And without thinking, I said, no, you won't. Mm. And it was just an instinctive response. I mean, I didn't mean it negatively,
right.
But I mean, it was out there then. I said, look, if you're not happy at $3.5 million in your 401k plan, I'm not sure that $4 million's
going to do. Oh, that's so true.
You know, and I've thought about him often because I thought his $3.5 million probably went down to $2.5 million. I was like, is this the kind of guy that's going to get so wrapped up in the numbers that he's just not going to recover, or he's going to make a dumb move, or... And, you know,
that is so true.
I've thought about him a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and wonder what happened. You know?
Yeah, that is interesting. I remember my friend Mark, you know, talking about that lady that had $5 million. And she's and then she had one client. He had this, you know, two clients. He likes to tell this story, and we've heard it a few times because he's a good friend of ours. But he likes to tell the story of this lady that had $5 million and another lady that had like $500,000. Mm-hmm. And the lady that had $5 million, just miserable and concerned. And that actually backs up the studies. The research actually shows that the level of anxiety with people, once they get that level of assets, it was like a 3.5 million or something like that. I forgot what the data says. It was something that to that regard, that once they get above that, a lot of times, not for everybody, but a lot of times what happens is your level of peace of mind and happiness actually starts to go down, because all of a sudden you feel so responsible for this money and you're so worried about what if I lose it. And whereas the lady with $500,000, she was happy-go-lucky. She'd go do things. She'd go, you know, spend time with her grandkids, and she was just having the time of her life. And he says that it hit me at that point that there was a purpose for money.
Yeah.
And that purpose was not money itself.
Right.
It was
right.
something bigger than that. Right. It was what values am I able to express through how I use my money? You don't need a dime. You don't need a dime to go sit with somebody in the hospital at their bed when they're sick and hang out with them and just spend time with them. You don't need a dime to go spend time with your spouse.
Yeah.
You know, I can attest that there are some of the best things that my wife and I ever did cost no money.
That's right.
You know, kind of going and just, you know, going out to the park or playing. I remember, you know, playing a video of a James Taylor concert on our wall in our living room and you know, just... Stuff like that, you know, that is
experience
really,
items.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that is what people are coming to, that's really what it's all about.
I'll tell you this story. If you want a humbling experience, help your parents guide them through retirement.
Mm-hmm.
That's always interesting. without giving up too much information, my grandparents, when my dad was getting ready to retire, we were talking about his assets and those kind of things. And I'd also helped my grandparents, and they had roughly $100,000, which was all they had.
Uh-huh.
And talking to my dad, I said, well, are you comfortable with these level of assets you have? And he looked at me and he said, look, your grandparents retired on $100,000. If I can't retire on this, we've got problems.
Your dad's great.
It's like, that puts it in perspective.
You got some good, really good dad stories.
I do. He's
all
pretty
right.
cool.
You are listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Supertalk 997 WTN. I think, you know, baby boomers, hey, look at it. They're finding maybe that there's more to life than just more money.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually a good thing. And I found that I had one client that was very sick. Mm-hmm. Came back okay from it. And I'm going to tell you something. He was changed.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
It was the most fun meeting I have ever had with him and his wife ever. And I think a lot of times we go through stuff like this. And we can come out on the other end with a whole new appreciation of what we're really here for. And it's way more than just money. I know that sounds funny coming from a financial planning group, but I absolutely believe that. All right. Let's change gears now.
You guys see, we're going to get a new neighbor.
You know, so one of the things I talk about is, you know, with markets and stocks, and people always were, oh, the market's going to do this, the market's going to do that, as if you can predict what the market's going to do. Okay, which market is always one of the things I always say. Is it large? Is it small? The micro cap? Are you talking about a small value, that market? Are you talking about international small value, that market? Are you talking emerging markets of value? So are you talking, you know, it's really... Are you talking about, you know, consumer durables? Are you talking about the technology market? Are you talking about the defense contractors? Which market are you talking about is going to go down? I mean, seriously, I mean, you think about it. It's ridiculous when you say the market's going to do this. There was, you know what? There was actually an article about that very thing. It was none other than Ken French. So, you know, a couple of people that I had, well, there are several people that I chased around the country stalking for years when I was trying to learn about this academic stuff with investing. And Gene Fama, the guy that won the Nobel in 2013, is one I always, often talk about. Ken French was his partner in crime, Ken French, Dartmouth guy. And he always had some great stuff too. Rex Singfeld, Wes Wellington was always really cool to listen to. But Ken French was actually quoted in this article. Bull markets usually don't end with a bang. So it said that unlike bear market bottoms, which tend to be short and violent, so you look at bear market bottoms, short and violent. What does that mean? Well, you're at a bear market bottom. So where are you going from there? You're going up. You have violent upswings. And this is the opposite of what most people think, isn't it? Most people think when stock markets crash, they come crashing down. And you hear all these predictions in the media. It's going to crash. It's going to come. It's going to collapse. It's going to blah, 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 blah. And actually, they're saying here that unlike bear market bottoms, which tend to be short and violent on the upside, of course, is what they're referring to, bull market tops in the stock market tend to occur gradually over time. First one sector or investment style hits its peak, then turns down, then another. And if you think about it, you go back and look at the S&P 500, 2000, 2001, 2002, 3 years in a row, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in 2000, S&P went down 9%, but value stocks actually went up. Mm-hmm. And then so did small value, and you had small companies. Then you have 2001, and you have small value companies up again. S&P went down 12, but value companies actually went up. And then you had small value up over about 30% return or so. So it wasn't the same stuff all at the same time. And then you got 2002, all of those aforementioned areas went down, but international small actually went up. So that's a really good point that they're making here in the Wall Street Journal, that, it's not necessarily that everything goes at the same time. It's not this big across the board. Another reason to be diversified really gets down to it. Means right. Investors shouldn't manage their stock portfolios on the assumption that there'll be exact day before which it would make sense to be 100% invested and afterward be in cash. But isn't that what we think about? Not us, but humanity in general.
The universe.
The universe. Thank you, Anne. I knew there was some reason I used that word. Isn't that typical that we, I think that I've heard the market's going to crash, sell in May and go away and all of that. And no, not necessarily. So what happens is that you'll find that it's little by little like that. Now, even if you pinpoint stock market timing weren't incredibly difficult, it would still make more sense to gradually build up cash as individual positions hit their peaks. And this is, in essence, what they're saying here in a fancy way. What you're doing anytime you manage a portfolio is you have areas of that are going to be doing better than others, mm-hmm. and you take the gains off the table
once
in a while. And we call that?
Rebalancing.
Yeah. And that's what rebalancing should be rather than, going in tactically, using tactical asset
allocation.
It's really
buying low and selling high.
Yeah, in essence, that's what you're doing. Yeah. So recent illustration, not all sectors and styles hit the bull market highs at the same time, came to the top of the internet bubble. And that's what they refer to. NASDAQ composite was 78% lower. 78%, bam. Say goodbye to lots and lots of your money. Well, it's just one example. It's not unique. Consider what I found analyzing, and this is French speaking, analyzing the 30 bull market tops since the 1920s that appear in the calendar maintained by Ned Davis Research. In each case, I determined the dates on which various market sectors hit their particular bull market highs, large, mid, small company sectors, as well as value, growth, and blend styles, as measured by price-to-book ratios. Thank you, Wall Street Journal, for using the right ratio when determining what value is. Averaging, they don't usually do that. I mean, it's usually...
Well, but Ken French does.
Yeah, Ken French, that's true. That's true. Okay, so it would be... Yeah. Good point. Point well made. Yeah. It was actually written by somebody who knew what they were talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's use a stable ratio.
Yeah, exactly. Averaging across all 30 bull market tops, there was a 225-day spread between the earliest date and that the sectors hit their tops and the latest, more than 7 months. So even when you do have things that go in, you know, in like fashion, you know, you'll have areas that keep going and you've sold them before they've hit their peak if you sold them early. You know, so it makes a whole lot of sense to not necessarily sit there for other reasons, one being that you can't predict the future, to not go and say, hey, I think the market's going to crash. Let's sell everything.
There's a chart, Paul, that you gave us, and it's been some time ago, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was looking at the, I think it was the S&P 500, and it was showing the going back about 20 years and showing that most of the time in some of those years, they had a low point, a negative time.
Yes.
But a lot of those years, the majority of the years, the market ended up positive for the year, and if you had acted on that, you would have lost out.
That's a really good one to remember, Jonathan.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the chart. I just have it in my mind, the visual of it.
Yeah.
But I've used that with clients numerous times saying, look, you know, volatility is your buddy here. And we have to measure it correctly. But, you know, the reality is that that's going to help you out. And if you get caught up in this number here, which is the noise, you're going to miss out on the thing after that. So I think that visual is just huge.
It is good. And that's something that I referred to that was actually married to that chart, which was the study that showed that 5% downturns in the market, which, you know, you look at a $30,000, 1,500 points. That happens on average 3 times a year.
Right.
You know, so you look at that and go, that's a pretty normal thing every 4 months, guys, historically, that markets drop in. And you know, when you think about a 1,000-point drop in the Dow, what they're remembering was when the Dow was, you know,
6,000 or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, it is a big deal. And it's also how it's presented to you. If I come up to you and say, hey, the market was down 1% today, you're really not going to think too much about that. But if I come up to you and I say, the market was down 700 points today, that's going to get your attention.
I'm listening.
So, all right, where do I go now? Where do I do it?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, to me, that's the thing that I think drives people nuts is just the, not only that, the availability to information that we have right now is next to nothing that we've ever seen, and sometimes that's not a great thing.
Oh, it's a terrible thing. and that's the reality of things. We get, as we often talk about, the first thing that we teach people is we go through a 7-step cycle. Fear the future. I want to predict the future. Tell me when the market's going to drop. I don't know when it's going to drop, but I'm going to find that person that predicted the last drop. So I'm going to look at past performance. And then what I do is I get overloaded with information because everybody tells me that they've got the golden gift to be able to tell me what the market's going to do next. And then I don't know who to trust, so my emotions take over and I just kick into emotional overload and I get greedy or I get fearful, you know, Bitcoin, that's it. I'm going to become rich. That was great if you did that, you know, 5-10 years ago. And if you were a person on the beginning of the bandwagon, that was great. But, you know, jumping on the bandwagon now for so many things, what are we doing? We're finding things that did well and we're jumping on those bandwagons, and that's greed speaking. And then you've got fear, you know, I'm just going to stick it all under a mattress, or loyalty, or, you know, I just worked with these people forever, or trust is another emotion that we go through. And then we end up breaking the rules of investing. Instead of buy low, sell high, we buy high, sell low. And then we have performance losses, and we do this over and over again. And that's another example of it when you have the internet, Jonathan, like you're talking about, where you have so much information and it's not helpful. It's just creating more anxiety. And then I end up, you know, just breaking those rules of investing with ever increasing frequency.
Yeah, we have a natural survival mentality. And when you talk about the greed aspect of it, I tell people all the time, if I had the ability to predict markets and know which way markets were going to go, why would I share that with anybody? Especially someone else that's investing in the same area that I'm investing in.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. Why would you give that information?
Yeah, you always need someone on the other side of the trade. Yeah.
Okay, so before I head to this, I did tease you with saying we got a new neighbor at the very beginning of this segment. I never got around to it.
Yeah.
So why is it that I don't ever worry about market downturns? What do I always say? Companies will do whatever they've got to do to be successful.
That's right.
If it's laying off half their employees, if it's moving out of the country, it's whatever. Well, you know, Smith & Wesson.
Nah, I knew that's where you were going. I was going.
Smith & Wesson to move their headquarters to Tennessee over Massachusetts' proposed gun legislation. So basically what's going on is they have new gun owners. They're driving sales ahead. It says this guy, you know, firearms and training discusses how new gun owners are driving sales ahead of President Biden delivering remarks on rising crime rates. Gunmaker Smith & Wesson Brands will relocate its headquarters to Tennessee next year due to proposed firearms legislation in its home state of Massachusetts. And in essence, what they're looking at doing is enacting legislation that would affect the manufacturing products that accounted for 60% of their revenue. Mm-hmm. So is Smith & Wesson just going, okay, we're just going to take it on the chin? No, we're going to pick up our toys. We're going to relocate from Springfield, Massachusetts, even though we have been there since 1852.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
1852. We're going to move. Why? Because a company, you're looking at targeting the most successful humans on the face of the planet when you are targeting wealthy people when it comes to taxes or it comes to legislation, and they are going to do whatever they got to do. That's why I love the stock market, because it's run by people. Companies are run by humans that will do whatever they got to do to get success.
Right. They're not going to just keep doing the same thing to go out of business.
Exactly. They are not dumb. Yeah. And that is another lovely example. Upward of 750 jobs will move from those facilities to the new headquarters in Maryville, Tennessee. Hey, welcome. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there, and if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.